Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Risotto is often considered an undoable home dish. Not so, according to freelance writer Susan Russo. We'll move from Susan's home kitchen to Mario Batali's restaurant kitchen at Babbo, where risotto is one of many things cooking on the stove. Then we'll take a look at saffron, those tiny red strands essential to some risotto and many other dishes. So let's dig in. Susan Russo is a food writer in San Diego. She publishes stories, recipes, and photos on her cooking blog, Food Blaga. She has written about risotto for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today from San Diego. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Bonnie.
So today we're going to talk about risotto. Why are people so terrified of risotto?
You know, I think risotto has gotten a really bad rap here in the United States. I think that people love to eat it, but they fear making it because of all of these horror stories that most people have about making risotto, that it takes too long, that you have to stand there and constantly stir for a half an hour or in really exaggerated stories, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, that it takes, you know, so much patience and so much attention to detail. But in fact, once you actually make risotto and once you start getting good at it, you realize it isn't that difficult. It's really just about following a series of steps. In fact, it only takes between 20 and 30 minutes to start risotto and then to have it actually finished and to sit down and eat it.
Why don't you walk me through the basics of risotto making so I can see just how easy it is?
Okay, first all you need is a wide, shallow, heavy-bottom pan. That helps distribute the heat evenly and to cook the rice evenly, and a wooden spoon. The next thing you want to do is you want to bring some broth, either vegetable broth or meat broth, depending on the risotto that you're using. You want to bring it to a simmer, and you want to add that hot broth to your risotto. The reason that it should be hot is that if you use cold broth, it shocks the rice and creates a rather undercooked, almost crunchy-centered rice that you really don't want for risotto. Then the first step you want to do is, in this pan, you want to add some onions with butter, or butter and a little bit of olive oil. And you want to sauté or sweat the onions until they turn translucent, which is just a few minutes. And then you want to add the risotto. And this next step is really important because it's partly what makes risotto unique. And that is you want to toast it or you want to braise the rice. And what this does is when the rice gets coated with the fat from the oil or the butter, it prevents it from absorbing the liquid too quickly and it results in a more tender, creamy risotto. The next step is adding some wine, which really will evaporate rather quickly, but the essence of the wine will be infused throughout the risotto, so it will have that wonderful flavor. Then you come to the part that everybody dreads, or a few people love, which is stirring. And there's some controversy over whether you should stir constantly or occasionally, and I can tell you from experience that you can stir occasionally, which is every 2 or 3 minutes, and still have a wonderfully creamy risotto. The key for a creamy risotto is to pour the hot liquid in slowly and to make sure that the rice has completely absorbed all of the liquid before you add more, and to also make sure that when you stir that you incorporate all of the rice in the pan, even including around the edges, and this will prevent any scorching from occurring. And also make sure that you keep your heat on a low heat because you don't want to have it too high, which could either burn the risotto or make the liquid evaporate too quickly. Then you want to taste it and make sure that it's done al dente, which means that it should be fully cooked, but it'll still be firm. And then the last step is called in Italian mantecare, which means that you turn the heat off, you add a knob of butter, and you add some freshly grated Parmesan cheese. And what this does is it allows it to melt slowly and just add some silkiness and flavor to the risotto. And then you serve it immediately.
The stirring is to just incorporate the liquid into the rice and make sure everything is coated and...
Yes.
So you don't have to do it constantly. You can do it.
No, because, for example, you add the broth about a half a cup full at a time. So say you pour that in. You can let that sit for a minute or two, and you'll see it bubbling, and you'll hear it bubbling. And then you'll start to notice after you do this a few times that you'll become more aware of the sounds that it's making. So that bubbling might start to slow, and then you look, and you notice that it's becoming thicker, and the risotto is swelling. So then now you you know it's time to stir it again. See how much liquid is left in the bottom of the pan. And if the bottom of the pan looks dry, then you know it's ready to add some more liquid to it.
Now, let's talk about the rice itself. I thought you could only use Arborio, but it turns out there are many different rices.
Yes. Basically, there are three primary types of Italian rice that are used for risotto. And like you said, Arborio is probably the most common here in the United States, but in Italy, they have several more. But what the three rices are, they're Arborio, Violone Nano, and Carnaroli. And what they all have in common is that they're all short grain, rather plump rices, and that they're all high in a starch called amylopectin. And this starch dissolves throughout the cooking process. And what it does is it gives risotto its characteristic creamy and slightly clingy texture that we love so much about it. The first one, Arborio, has a slightly larger grain, so that allows it to absorb liquid a little bit more easily and lends itself to a creamy yet al dente risotto. And this is widely available in United States supermarkets as well as Italian specialty markets. I like to look for Arborio that's labeled Superfino. That just indicates that it has a higher starch content and that it'll be an ultimately creamier, superior risotto when you finish. The second one is called Violone Nano, and that has a plumper grain, which makes it firmer after it's cooked, and some people like that better. And this is a popular type of rice in Italy, but it's not so popular here. It's a little bit more difficult to find, although some good Italian specialty markets here in the state should have it. And then the third one is Carnaroli, and that's called the king of rices, because in Italy it's really prized for its delicate flavor and its satisfyingly yet really firm, yet tender, creamy risotto. Although it's much more expensive, and it can be found usually online here in the United States.
Why can't you use Uncle Ben's?
You can't use Uncle Ben's because it's not the right type of grain, and it doesn't have the right type of starch that will release slowly that will create that creamy texture that you get from these types of rices.
Now, I go into restaurants now, and I see all sorts of risottos on the menu. In Italy, is risotto paired with seafood and vegetables and all of these things I see, or is this a new invention? Is it American?
Yeah, I think it's actually a little bit of both. In Italy, they do have it with all different types of meats and vegetables, like you were saying. And it also depends on the regional preferences. Here in the United States, risotto really didn't become popular until after World War II. And at the time, it was considered a great way for a woman to feed her family, a satisfying, nutritious meal that would stretch a long way and not cost a lot of money. And so it didn't really become popular in restaurants here until the 80s. And since that time, I think that the types of risotto we see have evolved significantly, like you were saying. So we have, you know, everything from really humble risotto with just a simple marinara sauce on it to something sophisticated with truffle oil or lobster in it, and as well as dessert risotto. So again, I think it's something that continues to evolve.
Talk about the dessert risottos a little bit.
Well, rice pudding, I think you would agree, is a really popular American dessert. And I think most people make it with regular long grain rice. But if you make rice pudding with Arborio rice, it is the most luscious, creamy rice pudding you've ever had. In fact, that's all I use now. I love it so much that I don't even use regular white rice anymore. And again, it has to do with that slow release of the starch. You don't stir it as frequently as you do when you make the savory ones. Usually when I make it, I just put it in a pan with some water and milk and sugar and spices like cinnamon or nutmeg and just kind of let it simmer so that it's slowly bubbling. And you let it bubble and you stir occasionally every, you know, maybe every 5 or so minutes until it gets really luscious and thick and velvety and creamy. And then you can do all kinds of toppings on it, anything from dark chocolate shavings to mixed nuts to some freshly whipped cream. You can stir in some poached fruit like poached fresh figs or prunes or pears. I mean, really, the options are just endless for it.
Oh, sounds fabulous. This all sounds so delicious. I am just really kind of drooling here. But Well, I really appreciate all these tips and can't wait to go home and try this. Thanks so much, Susan.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie.
That was freelance writer Susan Russo. friends did what Bill Buford did, you'd probably think he was nuts. He left a dream job at the New Yorker magazine to work as a kitchen grunt in one of New York's most famous restaurants, Babbo. The result is Heat, Bill Buford's book about his year in the Babbo kitchen and his search for the origins of Italian cooking. He spoke in 2006 with NPR's Madeline Brand about Babbo's chef, Molto Mario.
Hey, welcome back. Well, now, as you can see, with slow, proper cooking, we get these succulent little melanzane or eggplant out. And the main thing
a lot of us know Mario from his on-screen persona, his Molto Mario persona. Nice. Is he like that in real life? Was he like that in your apartment?
He's way, 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 way worse. He's way over the top. He's filthy, for a start. And he's very, very, very funny. You know, he came over with this gigantic top of a pig, basically raw pig fat that he came and sliced very thinly and delicately and intimately put on the back of our tongues and said, can't you just taste what the pig was eating in the last days of his life? Which is disgusting.
What is it about cooking, about restaurants, that attracts these characters?
There is a theory that the people who really excel in the kitchen are people who couldn't do anything but excel in the kitchen. It attracts a kind of person who can do things with his hands and work under pressure. It's not a verbal profession. They don't do what we're doing now. They don't use a lot of words. They don't read books. They don't read anything. It's all physical, and it's all with your fingers. So it does attract a certain kind of person that you don't find anywhere else normally in your civilized life. But in addition, there is something about food. I now describe it as the charisma of food that attracts a passionate personality.
And he allows you to work in his kitchen.
It wasn't a given. The kitchen is extremely small, and it's filled with some very highly driven, high testosterone, slightly mad, and in some cases very, very mad people working under a great deal of pressure, extremely long hours, and producing a lot of food. If you're not interested in cooking, it was a pretty miserable place to be. But if you're interested in cooking and you wanted to know how you did that and how you did this and what you do with artichokes and what you can do with fennel and how you can tell whether meat's done or not and how you cook pasta. And every time I turned, there was some new thing I didn't know. And it was like an intense, happy school experience. And I wanted to go back just because there was so much more that I wanted to learn. But I also wanted to go back because it was a pretty brutal experience, and I think I was excited by the challenge of proving I could do it.
You write in the book that not only did you get a little carried away, you actually went over to the other side, that you gave up your identity as a tourist, if you will, something that we journalists do all the time, is go in and sort of observe and then leave. But you became a participant. You became a chef, or a cook at least, a professional cook.
This is something that finally occurred to me when I got to Italy and was working in a butcher shop, and there was a moment when I realized, I'm a butcher. Not only that, but I'm an Italian butcher. And a tourist came in and took a photograph of me, and I thought, whoa, this is kind of confusing. I'm no longer the tourist, but I'm the tourist attraction. What journalists do, what we all do, is we get enough for our story. And sometimes that doesn't have to be very much. I never quite learned how to do not very much. But, you know, you go out and you get your copy and you can frame your story and you get your beginning and your end. And you often know what your story is before you begin. What I did was I lost my story. And, you know, I was no longer getting enough to write a book. I just went deep and was learning how to become a cook.
Because the initial impetus was to do a profile of Mario Batali, and it became more about you and your quest to learn about Italian food.
It became a quest to become a cook, to learn about Italian food, to learn Italian, to learn about food. It became a whole kind of Renaissance self-discovery reinvention thing. I didn't mean for it to do that. That just happened, and everybody was patiently waiting for me to return to the New Yorker. My publisher was patiently waiting for the book, and I was on an Italian hilltop singing songs.
I'm wondering, you go back to Italy to Mario's teachers, and they seem a little resentful of the fact that he's a big celebrity chef.
I finally made sense of it when I thought about all these musicians who used to go down to the Delta to learn how to play the blues. there's some amazing, amazing musicians down there, and they're very, very poor, and they've got astonishing licks, but there is, in all of them, even the very successful ones, a profound resentment of the white kids who come down and learn their licks and go back and become famous musicians. And it was a little bit like that. Mario comes, and I think Mario's a, they can't believe that he's a cook, and he tears the pasta, and he doesn't know how to do the things that they do, and they really kind of find him quite laughable. Only in time to be astonished that he sort of gathered up all their good recipes and converted them into the heart of a restaurant that is unbelievably successful in the middle of New York, and a television show, and another restaurant, and another restaurant, and a restaurant empire, and now he's an extremely wealthy man, and they still scratch their heads thinking, man, I can't believe that guy. I can't believe that was the same guy who came here. You go to Italy and you learn a way that people have been preparing food for hundreds of years. And Mario comes in and does them, but then he does, like, variations. And you don't do variations. What's this guy doing? And now he's a success and he does variations. It doesn't make sense to them.
So you end this journey by coming back to New York. You've spent several sojourns in Italy learning how to make pasta and butcher a pig and a cow and become quite adept in the kitchen. And what does Mario think of you at the end? Does he see you as an equal or a colleague or someone to be respected?
Well, in a couple, I was going to say a couple drunken moments, but actually only one of them was drunken. On a couple moments, he did invite me to start a restaurant if I wanted to start a restaurant. One was a very drunken moment, but that was counterbalanced by one which was very sober.
Did you think about it?
We thought about it, but I think what I understand now is how much work it is. And, you know, the point of this whole thing wasn't to learn how to start a restaurant. I wanted to understand the food that I eat and the food that I want to cook. And we're in a very peculiar generation where we're fantastically ignorant about the preparations of food, more ignorant probably than any other time in our humanity. At the end, I think I understand food better, and I know how to prepare more of it, and I still feel I've got a lot to learn.
Well, Bill Buford, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
That was NPR's Madeline Brand. In the historic medieval section of Cairo is an ancient spice store with hundreds of jars of green herbs, yellow beans, red lentils, blue incense, and saffron, an essential ingredient in risotto a la Milanese. This may be the same spice market where Cleopatra shopped. She put saffron in her hot bath water to enhance her desirability. Saffron is a multi-purpose spice used through the ages for making perfume, dyeing clothes, and for treating many illnesses, depression, the plague, gas. Today, it's usually kept in the kitchen cabinet, not the medicine cabinet. Just know that whatever you choose to do with these threads of reddish gold, you will pay dearly. Saffron has defied technology and takes actual human labor, a lot of it. The spice comes from the delicate, fall-blooming saffron crocus that grows in countries on the Mediterranean and in India. Spain, Iran, and India are all big producers. The Pennsylvania Dutch, by the way, have been growing saffron for centuries. Each lavender flower has three tiny red-orange filaments that must be removed by hand. It takes about 75,000 flowers for 1 pound of saffron. Hence, its reputation as the world's most expensive spice, as much as thousands of dollars a pound. Saffron threads are dried and packed in acrylic boxes or squat green-tinged glass bottles with corks. Fortunately, the good stuff is packaged in minuscule amounts, and a little goes a long way. You don't need a pound. You can get 2 grams of high-quality certified saffron in a pretty bottle for as little as $12. If this all sounds nutty, try bouillabaisse without it, or paella, or risotto. Saffron has a slightly bitter taste and a strong hay-like smell. Whatever it touches turns to gold, in color at least. And if you can't bear to see it eaten up, throw it in your bath and see what happens. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolf.